Called to order the House Revenue Committee. Welcome everybody here today. And Representative Patridge, if you want to come forward, we'll take up your House with whomever. House Bill 2676 first, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2676. And Ed, if you could give us the rundown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2676 extends the employer's dependent care assistance and referral tax credit through the 2003 tax year. Current sunset for that credit is the 2001 tax year, the tax year we're in now. This is a companion with the employer's dependent care facilities credit, which is RS 315.208, which also sunsets this biennium, but is not included in the sunset extension in the bill we have before us today. So it's something we may want to think about and discuss later. Both the dependent care assistance and dependent care facilities credits are available to employers who provide employees with qualified access to child care, either at an on-site facility or through available off-site child care service. And finally, extension of both these credits is included in the governor's budget. Estimated revenue impact of that is about $500,000 in the 2001-2003 biennium.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can you just say how much?
About $500,000 in the 2001-2003 biennium.
And that's for both tax credits.
That's correct.
That's for the package.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Rod Patridge, House District 50, Medford, and I'm here today on behalf of House Bill 2676 as a member of the Oregon Child Care Commission. And we are here today as part of the commission agenda in support of House Bill 2676 with Mark Overbeck and Mr. Powell from Powell's Books of Portland to testify on behalf of this. Ed explained to you kind of what the child care tax credit does. It is also available to be used for elderly and those with special needs as well as child care. It is critically important, I believe, to Oregonians with the lack of child care that's available. This is a way that employers can, as an employee benefit, help provide child care. It's estimated in some areas that 40% of the workers' absences are due to breakdowns in child care arrangements, and consequently we can keep more people employed if we allow these child care credits to continue. In 1997, 22 businesses claimed the credit. In 1998, 18 businesses claimed the credit. And most of that is used to provide cash assistance to employees, but a small portion of it has been used to provide billing centers and provide information referral services to employees for child care. Those are the primary reasons that this credit is being used, and I think it's a critical and important need in Oregon. There is a lack of child care throughout the state, and I believe we made some great strides last legislative session to provide safe, affordable, and quality child care in Oregon through some child care legislation. There is money in the governor and the co-chair's budget this time to provide some inspections and other things as part of a whole policy package. House Bill 2676 is a very critical and important part of the Oregon Child Care Commission's policy agenda for this legislative session to continue this tax credit.
Questions for Representative Patridge? Rob, I have one. Ed mentioned this other related tax credit for facilities. Do you have a feeling one way or the other as to whether you would prefer or not, I guess, to amend this bill to include the extension of that sunset as well?
That would be our preference, and
okay.
And most of it was, I think, in 1997 was the last figure that I have. Figures for $73,000 was used for building centers, so not a lot of people are building facilities necessarily with it.
And I was looking at the relating clause relating to dependent care tax credits. Is that broad enough I think to incorporate the facilities tax credit as well? I would expect so.
I believe that it is, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, who's next? Oh, Did you have a question?
Yeah, Rob.
Representative Bates.
How come so, you said 14 or 15 corporations took part in this?
1997, 22 businesses, and 1998, 18 businesses claimed this as a credit.
Oh, number.
Well, hopefully we will have some more enlightened employers as we progress in the future. I think it's, you know, not something that a typical employer usually thinks about as helping to provide child care. The commission has worked very diligently to do some outreach. I testified previously in Representative Canope's committee earlier this week to add an additional member from the private sector business community, as well as an additional person from the nonprofit sector to help stimulate some interest, we hope, and some more emphasis to for these kinds of programs in the state. But we want to have that available because we think it's critical to developing child care in Oregon.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up?
Are these mainly large corporations by any chance?
I think it's a mix. Mark Overbeck could probably speak to that better, and since he was the staffer for your predecessor at several points in time, that should be highly credible to you,
okay.
Representative Bates.
And one last point, mm-hmm. maybe you can mm-hmm. answer this too. If you don't work for that particular company but want to, we have a situation in Rogue Valley where we have a large employer who has a good child care center. Mm-hmm. And on a space available basis, I believe they allow them and the parents to bring their kids there, even though they don't work there. Would they still get a tax credit under those conditions?
I defer to Mark to answer the specifics on how. Mark knows the mechanics.
Okay. Oh, sir, Representative Hass, you had a question.
Thank you. Just on this point, I have the same kind of question that Representative Gates has. At the Beaver Chamber of Commerce, of which I'm a member, we had a little work group on workforce and some of these issues, and one of the, after a lot of meetings and words, there was this recommendation, well, there ought to be a law that does exactly what this law does, and finally somebody said, you know, there is this law. all these employers and these business people in the chamber did not even know that, and so I don't know how you get out to these people, because it's just a perfect idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I think that is critically important. I think that's why the commission chose to add these two additional members and brought it to the table as a policy advantage, I think, for the commission and for child care in Oregon. I think Mark's done yeoman's work in terms of trying to move the agenda forward with child care and what he's done there. Mark's been on board for a year, 10 months. Now, so I think we have some exciting times ahead. I think the commission is energized, and I think there's some new membership and good support and administration. So hopefully it will work.
Anything else? Okay, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Shetterly and committee members. My name is Mark Overbeck, and I'm the interim executive officer with the Oregon Commission for Child Care. As you know, the Child Care Commission is the governor and the legislature's advisory body on the child care issues in Oregon. Our members include representatives from the business and labor communities, child care profession and consumers of child care, medical, tax, and legal professions, state and local government, and also include three members of the Oregon legislature, Representative Patridge, Representative Gaffori, and Senator Bev Clarno. I do want to thank you for your timely hearing of this bill. As Representative Patridge alluded, this past Monday, we had a press conference where the commission released its report to the governor and the legislature, and included in those 9 recommendations was a recommendation to extend the sunset for the tax credits for dependent care. Oregon's businesses do recognize that child care is a workplace issue that impacts their bottom line. More Oregon employers are investing in child care for the workers, as part of a strategy to recruit and retain a quality workforce. The 93 legislature apparently understood this when they saw fit to create the employment department and place the functions of child care regulation in that agency, as well as the resources for the Commission for Child Care. And I do want to say that for the past several years, the employment department has been a very excellent supporter of our efforts to have safe, quality, and affordable child care available in the state. The Commission believes that the business community is a vital partner in the effort to make safe, quality, and affordable child care available for all Oregon families. That is in part why As another of our 9 recommendations, we're asking for 2 additional business members to be on the commission, one from for-profit and one from not-for-profit agencies. The tax credit has not been utilized as much as the commission would hope. Senate President Brady Adams in 1998 authorized a financing task force on child care issues. And when the task force concluded its work, it reached a conclusion that it wasn't a structural problem with the existing tax credits. It was, frankly, a lack of awareness on the part of business. The task force included a number of business representatives, most of whom did not know of this credit's existence. We have taken some steps through the Employment Department to better market this tax credit over the last 10 months. Channel 12 ran a Salute to the Workforce featuring businesses that had strong work-life policies and made use of this tax credit. I expect that we're going to see a modest increase in use just from that limited campaign alone. I would certainly welcome efforts, and we expect to get them from our new business members, to have this as a more well-known and a broader conversation. As you've heard, the governor's tax expenditure report has estimated the cost of the credit. The credits anticipated in both the governor's and the co-chair's budgets, and the Commission for Child Care requests your support of retaining the credit for an additional 2 years. Happy to answer your questions. Actually, I do want to respond to Mr. Chair Representative Bates' questions. Approximately 50-50 would be the split, Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, around large businesses and small businesses. My understanding is the last year we had tax information available from the Department of Revenue. About 50% of the businesses, $100,000 or more in revenue. The other 50% of the businesses who used the credit, that would be 9, had less than $100,000 in revenue.
I didn't know you could be a business with less than
$100,000
in revenue.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah,
it's false.
Michael Powell, Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to come and speak on behalf of the policy, of which I'm a strong advocate. 1988, thereabouts, there was a brief article in the Oregonian about the advent of this policy, and my wife was actually drew it to my attention one morning and said, "You've been talking a lot about child care, and here's an opportunity to do something about it." The challenge at that point was we were a small business. I guess we had more than 100,000 revenue, but what we didn't have was the 4 employees with children that we needed to make the benchmark. If the owner was, and I also had a child, if the owner was to be part of the program, and it took a year or so before we found ourselves with that number of employees. Today we have 52 people making use of this program. And that number has been fairly steady over the last few years. We haven't reached a maximum yet, but we've matched $75,000. Each employee has achieved benefit a total of about $3,000 a year. The maximum benefit is, I think, $4,800. The difference is people drop in and out. They don't use it all year long, or they're new or retired, or the employees retire mid-year. But a number of them use the maximum benefit, which we allow, which is $400 a month, half of which is matched funds from this program. It was critical for us to have a program like this to get us into child care. I share your puzzlement about why other people don't take advantage of it. I knew a couple of the companies on that list are people I've talked privately to and were excited to find there was a program. I also find there's great ignorance of this program. I suppose you're in a kind of Hobson's choice. I was hearing the revenue impact was $500,000, and probably that's not huge numbers in your world, though certainly significant. If someone said it was $10 million, you'd probably all sit there and take a deep breath and say, well, gee. So, you know, be careful what you wish for if you're wishing for success here. But I do think that there's certainly a much broader opportunity for companies to take advantage of this, and I'm certainly available to be a spokesperson on behalf of it. I think there are easy avenues to get the word out to business associations, advocates of child care, and other ways. It's been critical for us, I think, in a particular area which we've tried to strive, which is to attract and retain folks from the so-called hard-to-employ pool. We've made a conscious effort to recruit in areas of Portland where businesses don't often go to recruit, and our problem has always been, or would have been, ability to recruit single, particularly mothers, for whom child care is a critical issue. Being able to offer them a child care benefit has enabled them to come to work for us, stay with us, and in some instances, in fact, many instances, move on to full careers outside the book business. and I'm proud of that. If as a society we don't yet know what we want to do about child care, we certainly understand that if we want to reduce the number of underemployed and attack the pockets of poverty, child care is pivotal to that issue. As an Oregonian, I'm proud of the leadership shown by the state in instituting this program. I'm certainly glad to be a participant in it. My staff, I could have had 20 staff people here in a second. I didn't think you needed that. But there are people that desperately need this program, take advantage of it, feel greatly rewarded by it and proud of it, and proud of my company because we offer it, and I just find it a wonderful program. I don't suppose when I had 4 employees, I envisioned it would be 50 that would take advantage of it. I guess we're no longer a small company, but my people make on average between $8 and $12 an hour, certainly in the entry years. That $3,000 is a critical component of their ability to be able to work, stay in the workforce, and progress. So I'm available for questions, but I urge your support of this program.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me understand just how a small business goes about participating in this program. How do they do they set up a child care facility?
We didn't know. I'm not sure. I'm an advocate of setting up facilities. Facilities are enormously expensive, and I applaud whoever I think was Representative Bates said they had a company that did it. In Portland, certainly there's no lack of child care placement opportunities, though I guess many of them are often full, but there's quite a rich selection, and I never thought I should impose a one-size-fits-all child care program, even if I were inclined to. Some people prefer to have their children in a faith-based system, others in a Montessori system or in any variety or system. What they have to do is demonstrate to us with receipts that they put it in something other than grandma's home. We have had a couple of people try and pay their spouses, and we've blocked that sort of activity. But our people, they provide us with a receipt. We credit, we make the payment and then take it as part of our tax credit at the appropriate time in the year. As far as I know, administratively, it's not that difficult. Getting into the program, I guess you should speak to that, how tough it is to get signed up and in it initially.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, I may. I believe committee staff has distributed to you this handout, Oregon's Dependent Care Tax Credits for Employers. On the back of that, it lists the 4 steps that employers need to take to make this credit available to them. Essentially, the first is develop a written dependent care assistance plan. We call that a DCAP. It can be as simple as a 2-page plan that doesn't discriminate contrary to the IRS code. Secondly, to let the employees know of the plan, to maintain the records that Mr. Powell was talking about, and then to complete a form that's available from the Department of Revenue.
You know, as a small business owner and an employee, I'd never heard of this before, and I'm sure there's a lot of small business owners that haven't.
I'm one of the founding members of the Oregon Business Association, and I certainly put it on my agenda to see if we can't, through that avenue, speak up. There are plenty of other avenues one could, you know, plant this thought.
Hey, Representative Brown, we did this last session when we made this brave march through the tax expenditure report, looking at all these tax credits that we thought we could axe and get rid of. What we served to do was just highlight the fact that they're available, because a lot of people don't know them.
Yeah.
As soon as you put them on the agenda, why, folks come down out of the woodwork and say how great they are. And I think a lot of this really is a matter of just educating people as to the availability of these, because the policies are good, what they do is good, but sometimes it's tough to get them out and publicize. So even having a hearing like this, I think, is helpful.
Yeah, this, and particularly this one, which, you know, at the stubborn, hard-to-employ, that final, you know, whatever, 4% of unemployed, this is going to be one of the critical tools to get those folks back in the workforce.
Okay. Anything else for these witnesses? Yes, Representative Hess.
Quick comment, Mr. Powell. If the state were to spend some $10 million on this credit, going by your charts here, that would mean somewhere between $20 and $25 million of child care would be provide in this state, helping between 12,000 and 50,000 employees, depending on the circumstances of the company. I don't think that would be such a bad thing.
I would agree. I just, you know, I know what your revenue picture is here, and sometimes if your head's too high, it gets shaved. But I guess this is what the head's not very high on. But I agree. I was listening on NPR the other night, if I can take a moment, and they were comparing U.S. policies on childcare with European countries, and of course they've long had a different tradition there on social welfare issues, but, you know, the United States is the last industrialized country that hasn't a policy on childcare other than a lot of wishful thinking, and Oregon's policy at least is a pioneer in that, and the fact that people haven't stepped up, that's regrettable, but I think they would have given you, you know, they fully were informed of it.
Of course, I think if you've got a tax credit that's not being fully utilized yet, it's early, probably moving too soon to talk about extending it. I think what you do is you try and get that utilization up so that people are pushing up against the limit, and then the pressure comes up from the bottom to make it more available.
Well, if I had the best of all possible worlds here, I'd probably be advocating today that the credit be increased. It was $200 a month in 1988. It's still $200 a month. It buys you about half now what it did then. And we all know child care workers are not well paid, and these things are extremely fragile. So, you know, that. But I'm not here to do that today because I think we need to keep the policy in place.
Okay. Thank you very much. Becky Shine. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Becky Shine. I work as Child Care Program Officer at the Enterprise Foundation. We are a housing and community development organization that has worked over the last two decades with small and large businesses and working parents. We would like to recommend that you do extend the sunset on this credit because of its benefit both to employees and to employers who might not otherwise be able to afford providing these services to their employees. Clearly, as we know, businesses rely on productive, stable employees. And one of the things we found from working with low and moderate income working parents is that child care costs can rise up to 20% to 40% of their income, monthly income. And we've also seen in some businesses that up to 50% of the absences are due to child care arrangements falling through. So it's to benefit both of the employee and the employer for the employer to be able to offer assistance, either through cash assistance or operating a center or information referral services. We also know that there's many businesses who require high-skilled professional employees, and that these kind of benefits are also crucial to those folks, who are then easier to recruit and maintain. So we hope that you will vote to extend the sunset. We see it as very beneficial both to businesses, employers, and their own children. Thank you very much.
Questions from Ms. Shine before she runs away? Yes, Representative Beck.
Do you see any advantage or any reason to talk about increasing the amount of the credit?
It's a very interesting question. Actually, we are actually working with Representatives Westland, Tafori, and Senator Brown, who have agreed to be chief sponsors on another pilot that would sort of build on some of what we're doing here, and would address some of the concerns you've raised about the use of it and try a sort of simultaneous pilot to see if we can increase business use. So we'll be coming back to you as a revenue committee to look at that. So I think there are actually some other opportunities to sort of try simultaneous efforts to see what's the most effective way to incent businesses to contribute.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other witnesses here to testify today on House Bill 2676? All right. Then I will. I've asked Ed to go ahead and prepare an amendment to incorporate the facilities credit as well. And when we get that back, we will bring the bill back up. Okay. That will conclude the public hearing then on House Bill 2676. I'd like to go next to 2677. Do we need Representative Mercury for that? Okay. I'll go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2677. Maybe Paul can speak slowly and tell us what the give us the summary. Oh, and I see we've got a witness before. Okay. All right. Well, good.
I need them. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2677 requires it gives taxpayers an option of requiring the Department of Revenue to have a direct deposit on refunds. And the way the bill is originally written, it is incorporates both personal and corporate income taxes. You do have an amendment before you that would limit that to individual taxpayers only, the dash one amendments. And the bill, as written in terms of the dash one amendments, is built into the governor's budget as part of the Department of Revenue's budget. So there, we don't have a fiscal impact yet. There is a fiscal, if you include corporate, but if it's personal income taxpayers only, fiscal hasn't informed me, there would not be a fiscal impact.
Oh, is that right? If we adopt the dash one amendments, there's no fiscal impact?
No, it would be part of, built into the governor's budget. That's the perfect way to say it. So the bill itself will become effective on January 1, 2002, and we do have Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue to answer any questions on how that fits in with our budget.
All right. Deborah, why don't you come on up?
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Oregon Department of Revenue. We asked the emergency board in December of 99 for 14 information technology positions, and those were granted, and one of the projects that we intended to work on was direct deposit. So we do have that in our plans to do, and we hope to be able to do it before the date mandated in the legislation.
Okay. We did have some conversation this morning, or I did, with the co-chairs, Representative Westland in particular, as to the difference between the fiscal impact and in the governor's budget, in that we're not supposed to assume anything, I guess, from whether something's in the governor's budget. Do you know, have you gotten some direction from the co-chairs as to their plans with the fiscal piece of this?
Mr. Chair, I have not.
No, okay.
Although my understanding is that we are not requesting funding from Ways and Means for this, because we have received the positions from the emergency board already in December of 99.
So won't we need to budget those for the next biennium to roll those forward? Oh, that's fine. I can ask these questions to the board chairs. I just want to make sure we don't. We're trying to be very careful, aren't we?
We are trying to be careful, Mr.
On dollars and cents. Okay.
We should have our hands full.
The department, though, is satisfied with this and ready to go to town.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, yes, Representative Epps. I'm sorry, Deborah, if you could wait for a second. Representative Epps.
Not so much a question, Deborah, but I think while we wait for Representative Merkley, I'm just wanting to raise, if this is an effort at efficiency, I think it is, then what do you think about perhaps doing this with kicker refunds? I mean, if the same argument holds true, that this is an efficient cost-saving step, or at least a more efficient step, then wouldn't that argument translate for direct deposits or kicker refund step?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I was afraid someone would ask that. Mm-hmm. We've thought about that, and we may actually be able to do it, but there could be some difficulties around it. The way this will work, as I understand it, the taxpayer will indicate on their Oregon return that they want their refund check to go into a certain bank account, and those returns are generally filed in April. Kicker checks aren't mailed until November or December. So there's a little bit of concern about the time lag from April to November with changes that can occur, death of the taxpayer, changing a checking account, and so on. So if we did that, we'd anticipate that there would be more rejects of the direct deposit and perhaps more costs there, not to say that we could not do it. Also, those returns that are filed that have tax to pay won't have the information on them, so they clearly would get a check again for any kicker refund.
Yes, Mr. Chair, on the dates there, it's effective January 1, 2002. So the first time the kicker would be affected, conceivably, wouldn't be until the 03, fall of 03. So this bill wouldn't have any effect on the 01 kicker if there is one.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to that, I suppose the most efficient thing to do with respect to kicker checks would be to give tax credit as opposed to
Well, Well, we used to do that.
I know. I almost introduced that bill, and didn't see the leaves on the tree, so but I think it's interesting to discuss.
Thank you for listening.
You're welcome.
What can you tell us?
Representative Shetterly, members of the committee, I'm Judy James with the Legislative Fiscal Office. I didn't realize the Dash 1 amendments were already out. With the Dash 1 amendment, we anticipate a fiscal impact of about $122,000 for the biennium, which is included in the governor's budget for this program. By the 03-05 biennium, revenue is projected a slight savings of about $9,000.
Do you know the $150,000, is that in the co-chair's budget as well, or have we gotten that far?
We haven't gotten that far.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Helpful information. Will we be getting a fiscal impact statement on this then? Would you? Okay. Thank you. Representative Merkley, you want to bring your, I assume, constituent?
Yes.
Is it Hartel?
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
For the record, Representative Jeff Merkley from East Portland, and it's a pleasure to appear before your committee following up on an idea that came from one of my constituents who is able to be with us today, Mr. Glenn Hartel. In March of the year 2000, Mr. Hartel contacted me and said he'd been in conversation and correspondence with the Department of Revenue about the idea of creating a structure for direct deposits, that this structure existed at the federal level, that it had a number of advantages for people. And rather than get into that myself, I wanted to invite Mr. Hartel to explain what his thinking was, and then I'll follow up with some comments.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Glenn Hartel. I'm from East Portland. I'm a retired Oregon taxpayer. I support this legislative measure. I think the chief benefits of this would be of a senior concern. Seniors don't have to worry about a check in the mailbox or being left on the street, particularly if they were confined to the house or in a hospital. There'd be no muggings, no stealing from mailboxes, which is very prevalent in our area. If they go on vacation or were out of town, they would not have to be concerned about that because that check would go directly to the bank. Apartment dwellers may have the same concerns where there's mass mail delivery. Other people have an access to their mail. I believe this to be a win-win situation for everyone involved. The state saves on postage, materials such as envelopes, paper. Everything is done electronically by tape. It's an easy and safe solution to a large concern of senior citizens in the state of Oregon. Oregon is one of the leaders in the nation in concerns for senior citizens. This is just one more step, I think, to show the rest of the United States that Oregon cares about senior citizens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, after hearing Mr. Hartel's comments, I thought that his comments had a great deal of merit, that seniors do worry about a lot of things, and one of the things they worry about is that when people know what day the kicker checks are coming out, for example, that they are vulnerable to having those checks taken out of their mailboxes. And a number of people on my street in southeast Portland have had that experience of having their checks then used on the basis of forgery. And this just seemed like a way to improve efficiency and benefit seniors and others simultaneously. I therefore contacted the department to lobby for this idea, and they said that it was not one that they hadn't considered, and in fact they were hoping to implement this by the year tax year 2001, which sounded good to me. I realized that there were complex programming tasks involved, so I really brought this bill forward as a way to remind the department that this would be of great benefit, because I know that in the course of pursuing ideas that haven't been laid out in a formal way, those that have been sometimes take precedence, and this idea could very easily get lost. So I'd like to encourage the committee to adopt this bill with the Dash 1 amendment in order to address the concerns that Mr. Hartel has so eloquently presented. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of either Representative Merkley or Mr. Hartel? I want to welcome Representative Merkley back to the Revenue Committee.
It is never the last delight to be here.
Yeah. All right. I want to thank you very much. We will await the fiscal impact statements. I'll have a hallway chat with the co-chairs, make sure we know what their intentions are with this then, and get back in for a work session as soon as we can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We will close then the... I'm sorry. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on House Bill 2677? If not, we will close the public hearing on that, and I think that concludes our bills for the day. Is that right? Okay. We will not be taking up... 2204 Now, we have, as you've seen on your desk today and yesterday, we are visited today by Joan Sawicki, and we're a little bit ahead of schedule, but I'd be pleased to bring you forward. She's got, this is not relating to a bill, but an informational testimony. The honorary title is the Honorable, is that it?
Well, I used to be honorable when I was a minister, but I'm now a backbencher, so I guess that means I'm no longer honorable.
Well, I want to welcome you to the House Revenue Committee. I understand you've already had your brown bag conference in the governor's office, but we're happy to have you with us today, and I'm pleased to give you the floor.
Representative
Yes.
I'd like to extend a special welcome to you. I went to junior high and high school in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Thank you.
What was your district as minister?
Actually, I was Minister of Environment, but my riding, which is your district, is Burnaby, just
all right,
outside Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. We got some beaten basketball here by them. Well, yes, okay.
Well, I like Nanaimo bars.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Representative Shirley and members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Sarah Dahl, and I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. And we're here today with Joan Sawicki, who, as you now know, it was the immediate past Minister of Environment for British Columbia. She's currently still a member of the legislature, so she's in a similar position with y'all, and she was the former speaker up there. She created the Green Economy Institute, which she'll tell you a little bit more about within the British Columbia government. She's down here to talk about environmentally sustainable tax reform, and we thought we would bring her here to y'all today because you will be considering in the next couple of weeks a sustainability study bill which looks at the concepts that she's going to talk a little bit about. So, with no more ado.
Well, thank you very much to the committee for giving me the opportunity to just present this, and I'm very pleased to do so. I actually personally have been working on sustainability for about 15 years, all of my tenure as an elected person. And I also know that Oregon has really taken leadership as well, and I've often used some of the work you've done as a model, most recently your sustainability charter. So if I can come down here and perhaps share some of the experiences that we've had around environmental tax shifting, pollution taxes, whichever, green taxes, whichever you want to call it, and just let you know the experience we've had with it and why I certainly support the initiative that is going to be coming forward to you in a couple of weeks. Before I start on the specifics, and we did have some overheads, I have staff here, they might just there's just a few words on each of them and you can keep them later so you don't have to make too many notes. I think as legislators, we know that there are massive changes happening in our own societies here in North America and certainly around the global marketplace. Public concerns around clean air, clean water, protection of biodiversity, public concerns about jobs and how are we going to have enough of them, around human health, the impact of economic activity on human health, and also the changing public values of what they want in terms of a quality of life in their communities and for their grandchildren. coupled with that, what I call this greener global marketplace, I think it's going to give us a real reality check as we plan our economies. I hope in a positive way. I think the Pacific Northwest of our continent, we have been the home of much progressive thought, and I hope this will be another of them. In British Columbia, certainly the reality check came first and foremost in our forest industry and the very effective international market campaign against BC Wood. However, through looking at that reality and realizing that change must happen, many of our most progressive companies now are welcoming certification, embracing outside auditors in terms of protecting fish habitat and biodiversity, et cetera, because they know that's what's going to keep them competitive and right at the cutting edge of the marketplace. So whatever motivates, certainly I think that there are many, many reasons why we would want to be at the front of the line as we move towards sustainability globally, I hope. Ecologically sustainable, economically sustainable, and I also very much include socially sustainable, quality of life for our citizens in our communities. It's those kinds of things that I've worked on, and that's what really got me very interested to embracing tax shifting. I learned about tax shifting from the Northwest Environment Watch book called Tax Shift and Alan Durning. So I'm one of his students, if you want to call it that. So I thought I would, just in the time we have available, give you just a sense of what we've done in the last couple of years on this. We started out sort of mid-99. I call this my necessity, mother of invention impetus. I'm basically an environmentalist, a member of a government that in that time was very focused on economic development and jobs. So my job was to try and influence the economic agenda, the very legitimate economic agenda of our government. We commissioned a discussion paper on tax shifting just to so that we had something out there in the public, business, community, labor groups, environmentalists, local governments, etc., saying, what is this thing called tax shifting? Roughly parallel to what I understand the proposal might be in the bill upcoming, to commission a discussion paper to look at alternatives. We also held several consultations, did some polling, focus group, workshops. And what we heard back, once people understood that with tax shifting, it wasn't more tax or less tax kind of dialogue, it's asking what we tax. And asking the question, is our tax system really reflecting our values? Does it really incorporate the environmental costs of what we do, the human health costs, the costs of what we're passing on to future generations? And wouldn't it make much more sense, since we usually get more of what we don't tax and less of what we do tax, wouldn't it make sense to kind of remove some of those taxes from things that we want, like jobs and economic diversification and investment and all those good things, and put them onto the stuff that we don't want, like pollution, waste, and resource overuse? So the responses were very interesting. Firstly, we found there was general support for tax shifting. It made sense to people. I was perhaps the first environment minister that actually went to talk to the BC Business Council, BC Chambers of Commerce, and some of the leading corporate sector said, yeah, we're kind of interested in talking about this, thinking about this, because they could see that if they then embraced retrofits to reduce their pollution or waste, that they could actually benefit on the bottom line. And that interested them. Obviously, the devil is in the detail and all of these kinds of things, and certainly in our focus groups, there were some concerns, and they are legitimate concerns to watch for, to ensure revenue neutrality. This is not a cash cow to put more dollars into the treasury. Concern about competitive position, impact on low-income earners, regional equity, how would a tax shift affect urban versus rural, et cetera. So we've gone through those consultations. We then brainstormed about 60 pilots, did much work on several of them. I just want to mention one pilot right now, I think our greatest success, and that was something that you'll probably be familiar with, what we call beehive burners, and the treatment of sending up into the air with all its particulates, et cetera, wood waste from mills. As of January of this year, we have now implemented a very tight and successful tax shift project whereby mills will actually pay $10 per ton greater pollution permit fees than previously, but they have an opportunity if they choose to invest in alternate technology or into research or commercialization of that alternate uses of wood waste, they can get rebate for that increased fee. That has instantly put up to a potential $1.2 million into environmental innovation, research, and commercialization of better uses of wood waste. So we are very pleased with that pilot project. We have also since done a second discussion paper around vehicle emissions, and it looks at around 22 different options for trying to encourage consumer behavioral change in terms of the kinds of vehicles we drive, and certainly going right to the source, the kinds of vehicles that the vehicle manufacturers actually build in terms of mileage efficiency and energy emissions. That paper is available. That has been, of course, very controversial because when you hit people with a private automobile, you're really going into dangerous territory as a politician. But I wanted to mention that because I understand the bill you'll be discussing, the Sustainability Study Bill, actually suggests approaching sustainability and a look at tax shifting from looking at the disincentives. And from the public's mind, I think that this is a very interesting direction that I will certainly be looking forward to seeing how it works. Because instantly people say, well, it should be cheaper to do the right thing, whether in my personal life or as a corporation. And if I choose to take care of the environment, choose to take my bicycle instead of walking, choose to buy a more efficient car, I choose to reduce my energy use by alternate energy, it should be cheaper and I should benefit from that. So by looking at the disincentives in the tax systems, the disincentive to sustainability, I think that that is an innovation that we have not yet done in British Columbia, so I would look forward to seeing how Oregon proceeds on that basis. I know that our time is short here, and so I think that I will just end on a couple of notes. Looking 2 years down the road from when we started this, I think our successes are basically, one, the word tax shift is now on the radar screen in British Columbia. The media talks about it. It's in editorials. It's part of the public debate, and I think that is a good thing. We have pilot projects out there, and it also has helped give us a new tool around our green economy and our sustainability direction. Some of the obstacles, I think we all know them. We're all politicians here. The public perception about overtaxation and this mantra of tax cuts make it a little bit difficult to get across your message that this is revenue neutral, this is not how much or how little we tax, but what we choose to tax and make sure that the marketplace is actually telling us the truth about the real cost of our activities. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the obstacles one runs into in trying to advance this concept is that certain people in industry, primarily manufacturers and those in the natural resource sector, see these proposals as measures that are designed to injure them, to put more burden on them. How do you address that concern?
Well, I address it several-fold. Industry already has a lot of regulations, a lot of environmental regulations and standards. In British Columbia, we have a fair number, and I think because Oregon cares about the environment and quality of life, you probably have a lot too. Sometimes things are best dealt with regulations and standards. But what tax shifting does says, well, just a second. Maybe using the tax system can help remove some of that red tape and regulation and thereby also cut some public costs in administrating this massive, this massive regulations that we have. So that is one thing I would say. The other point I would mention is what's happening in that greener global marketplace, and it's pretty clear, I think, to the leaders in virtually every sector. Forest sector is first to hit the wall, but I suggest every other sector will meet it. The leaders are going to look around and say, if I want to sell my product, I'm going to have to be clean and green. And that's what's going to keep me at the cutting edge of competitiveness. So I think that's a good argument.
Full, Mr. Chair. Second question is, if through some kind of environmental approach to taxes, a state like Oregon significantly shifts its tax burden onto activities that currently are not maybe fully taxed in line with the consequences of their behavior, how do you address the competitive balance in terms of businesses that are competitive to the businesses here in Oregon that would seem to have some advantage in terms of trade or in terms of competition?
I don't have a definitive answer for that. Tax shifting is not sort of a panacea. It's not sort of a silver bullet. But our current tax system has evolved over several decades, and incrementally it can start shifting those taxes to discourage the kind of environmental degradation that I think is costing us a lot of dollars in terms of human health and also quality of life in our communities. In terms of the competitiveness, companies need to find their own way through it, and I've certainly met with some of the major corporations in British Columbia. They still have to make their good management decisions. But I maintain that if, in fact, we design tax shifting carefully to be truly revenue neutral, sometimes sector-based, sometimes even corporation-based, you can make sure that you are actually removing some of their tax burden in one area, in the areas that we want to encourage them to create jobs or expansion or do energy retrofits, etc. And they then have the choice to avoid those extra taxes that you are putting on emissions. So it does give companies a greater range of choice as to what direction they want to go.
How much of this incremental tax burden, as we look at shifting taxes, how much of this would fall on business and how much of it would fall on individuals?
That's dependent on what you choose to use as your pilot. British Columbia, go ahead.
Let's assume for a minute that we're applying a fair standard here and we're not just trying to impose taxes on business and we're not trying to impose taxes on individuals. But if we follow through with this approach to taxation, and ultimately, where does this burden flow? To which sector? Does it flow to business? Does it flow to individuals? If not, I mean, obviously it's both to some extent, but how do you see the balance of that compared with the current balance in most tax systems?
I guess I see it in a more holistic way. This is not a tool, in my opinion, that tries to target one sector or business versus individuals, etc. I see tax shift thinking, I see sustainability thinking as needing to permeate virtually everything we do. In British Columbia, we are taking a holistic sustainability approach and saying we need to green up government operations. We need to motivate businesses to become more sustainable. We need to motivate local communities to build their communities better, and we need to motivate individuals to change their personal lifestyles. So within any sector or group, you're going to have different winners and losers, perhaps, than you do now. But the bottom line, if this works as well as I think it has the potential to work, your winners will be those people who choose to do the right thing. And your losers would be those who are creating those costs, those human costs, economic costs, and environmental costs that we, then the public, need to fund to fix.
Representative Bates.
I sometimes work better from example than I do in sort of global thinking. Representative Witt brought up something that's a real problem for us, and that's products coming from outside the state and outside the country and into our economy at a very lowered rate of sale because there's no regulations in some of these countries as far as environmental concerns are concerned. And in my particular area, fruit coming in from Chile is coming in cheaper than we can grow it. So if we want to tax shift, let's say, the production of pears and peaches like you would do over in Penticton, we would have to shift that somewhere else. I mean, you give that group a tax break, we have to shift it somewhere else. Where do you make that decision of where to shift that to? I mean, if I take it off, we try to take it off the growers in Southern Oregon, and it's supposed to be tax neutral for both the state and the individual corporation or individual person, where do you shift it to? How do you make that decision where to shift it to?
I've often actually used a very similar example when I talk about our tax system not really reflecting the true costs. And I say, look at, you know, we bring in a head of lettuce from Mexico. Now, we know, and it's 5 cents cheaper, 10 cents cheaper than our next door neighbor farmer can grow it. Now, we know that head of lettuce is not cheaper. The only reason it's cheaper is because the marketplace doesn't really incorporate the true costs of fossil fuel, energy, or the transportation. If it did, of course it would be cheaper to buy it from your next-door neighbor. In agriculture, I think that that is a big issue. We have been working with the agriculture sector, and our whole legislature right now is working on an agriculture vision for British Columbia. We have great difficulty even competing with Washington in terms of apples because we just don't have the economies of scale. So I think that in the short term, we do need to make sure that we make judicious use of tax shifts so that we do not penalize the parts of our industry that already have difficulty competing. What might be doable in the agricultural sector, let's say around apples, would be very different than maybe the greenhouse sector. The goal in my mind, and I don't think any governor or government in our sense or group of legislatures want to negatively impact businesses in their jurisdiction. But you can take steps to help reward niche marketing in agriculture, which is one thing we're looking at, you know, the clean, healthy, homegrown food without pesticides, do you know what is in your food, etc., and doing the public education to make sure British Columbians choose to support their BC farmers because they know in the long run they're getting healthier food and they're keeping the jobs in their community. So, I mean, this does not replace any of the other tools that all of us use in government. This is only one more tool in the toolbox, and it helps to address some of the real public concerns and public costs of environmental degradation.
I'd be curious to know, there's a policy side to this and there's a political side to this, and looking at your external challenges in the handout that you've distributed, for instance, I see a headline from the Vancouver Sun, December 28, 1999, making polluters pay benefits the rest of us, which sounds pretty warm and receptive. And then exactly a year later, December 28, 2000, read our lips, no new taxes. That's also the Vancouver Sun. What's happened?
Well, it's no different than what often happens with these issues. As I say, certainly at a high level, principal level, you get the head nodding and say, yes, this makes common sense. When you try to implement, especially when you start affecting your, you know, people's personal life choices, let's say the vehicles that they drive.
That was another headline.
That's right. Then you kind of get into trouble. And in that instance, and we've certainly learned some lessons over the release of the second discussion paper, what had 22 options. I think all options that need to be looked at to see, will this bring us the benefits we want it to bring without negative impacts, there was a huge lobby from the automobile dealers against what we called the feebate, doing some shifting of taxes from polluting cars to more fuel-efficient, cleaner cars. There was a huge lobby, and we basically lost that battle in the media. So we are kind of retreating and regrouping on that. However, in the upcoming budget, I am hoping that we will at least be able to do the carrot part as a start to give some rebate or credit to those more fuel-efficient, lower-emission cars. So those people who choose to buy them actually get a benefit. But this is controversial. There's no question, but I think discussion around taxes always are. It's a matter of finding things that are doable. I mean, politics is the art of the possible, right?
Down here, too.
Mm-hmm. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck.
What seems like part of the challenge for us is getting the concept of tax shift into the public discourse beyond what you call high principle people, and I hear from a lot of my constituents, very educated, upper middle class constituency, and they always come talk to me about tax shifting. So they know, but they're all talking to themselves, and as we often are down here. And I'm wondering how to get beyond people, you know, intellectual crowd, and out into how do you market this? How do we go to a next step short of coming up with some scary proposal that people will knee-jerk and the anti-government demagogues will win the war on? Before we do that, how do we market the concepts? I think Alan's book is extraordinary, and I would encourage all members to read it. It's one of the few things I've read in the last 2 years and all the junk mail we get that I found actually interesting. So anyway, long question. How do we get to the next step?
First I want to second what you said about Alan Durning's book. And actually all of Northwest Environment books tend to be that way. I think I probably handed out 3 or 4 dozen of tax shift books to my colleagues in the legislature and anyone else whose briefcase I could kind of slip it into, because it is written in a format that does connect with people, and you have people saying, yeah, this makes sense. That is the first step, and that's why I think a sustainability initiative or a discussion paper is the first step. We did, I think, around 9 or 10 workshops, focus groups, et cetera. That is always difficult, and I don't think that we have any better ways of doing it than you do, except to say that as somebody who is a strong environmentalist, spent 15 years at various levels of government as an elected person, I am absolutely convinced that if you can get through to people, that is really where the public wants us to go. They want to believe that we can maintain this quality of life, pass on a clean environment to their grandchildren, and have sustainable jobs. They don't call it sustainability. They may not even call it tax shifting. But if we can put this kind of tool into that kind of context and say, why can't we have that, and have them understand that perhaps one of the answers to that question is, well, because we've created this monster called this tax system, and it keeps taking us the wrong way. They say, well, let's fix the tax system so it takes us the direction we want to go. That's the kind of debate that I think is happening across British Columbia in a relatively short time. They say, I remind you that we've got editorial writers now on their own volunteering a tax shift solution to a complex problem. That's the beginning of the infiltrating of the kind of thinking.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. I'm not sure if this is applicable to cost shifting or to tax shifting, but in Oregon, for example, we have a cigarette tax that has a component of tobacco cessation in it. And if we are successful with our tobacco cessation program, we actually diminish the behavior, then we lose the revenue from the tobacco tax to fund the health programs. Is there a dynamic within the cost of the tax shifting that you're talking about that will allow you to sustain revenue? Because ideally we would all move towards good behaviors, and then once we are all behaving well, where do we get our revenue, I guess, in the ultimate end of it?
Well, when it comes to cigarettes, you're talking to a member of a government that just decided to sue them, sue all the companies for the health care costs. That's a very good question, because all of our governments are funded more or less by unattractive behaviors such as drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes. So the revenue neutrality aspect doesn't address that, but I think it also, one of the attractions of a tax shifting is also recognizing that all of us as governments are dealing with tighter and tighter budgets. We're not going to have the kinds of dollars in the Treasury to do all of the social policy things that we want to do. And therefore, governments have to find a way to shrink their expenditure. Well, again, this is not a panacea. I think tax shift can play its fair share of a role to reduce the necessity for some of the bureaucracy and administrative kind of complexity that all of our jurisdictions have built up over the years, because we're going to have to find some way to meet the needs of our constituents in all of the areas with tighter and tighter budgets, because I think your constituents and ours are saying no new taxes. That's why we need to have a different debate, and tax shifting may be part of that debate.
Anything else? Well, I want to thank you again for coming in and spending time with us today. It's a pleasure to have you as our guest.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay down here. Thanks very much, and I want to thank for bringing her in. We're glad to have you. With that, committee, we are adjourned until tomorrow.